This week, we continue our conversation with first baseman and designated hitter for the Kansas City Royals, Mike Sweeney. Music by AMR and Robert Lee McClure, practical improvement tips, and much, much more.
This is Playing with Fire. He's at the 20, the 10, the 5. Touchdown!
3 seconds remaining. 2-1. Shots up. It's good!
Here's the pitch, the swing. It's a long fly ball. It's going, going. It's gone! Revealing the secrets of the elite athlete. But be careful. You're playing with fire.
Freestyle. Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Bill Thierfelder back with Playing with Fire. I think we have a great show for you today. Pretty kind of range of ideas here, you know, going from how do you get faster, you know, learning how to develop speed. Everybody likes to know how to do that. Basically, is there virtue in catching a big fish? I'll have to explain that one to you. And basically, you know, understanding ourselves and others and doing it with trust and perseverance. And so let's just get right to it. Listen up. In this episode, I wanted to continue our conversation with Mike Sweeney of the Kansas City Royals, 5-time All-Star and just an all-around great guy.
Well, welcome, everybody. I have a great guest today. He's a first baseman designated hitter for the Kansas City Royals, number 29. You'll guess his name as I tell you who he is. 5-time American League All-Star team member. One of the things that's impressed me about Mike Sweeney has been his one game. I guess I haven't heard of other people doing this. I'm sure there's been a few, but an actual grand slam and a 3-run homer in one game. I mean, that is just incredible. That must have been awesome. And I don't know if I'll have time to ask you about that, but I'd like to know how that felt to do that. But you've been active in your faith. You've been on Life on the Rock. You've done some things with the stem cell research ad that came out that was just fantastic. You've recently been in a movie, Champions of Faith. And so, you know, Mike, I want to welcome you. Mike Sweeney from the Kansas City Royals. You're just, you know, an amazing model, and you're somebody that, you know, certainly what this web, you know, site is about, Reclaim the Game, and the podcast about trying to show that, you know, you can be a world-class athlete, have virtue, have faith. And so I just want to welcome you to the program.
Well, thanks, Dr. Bill. I'm really excited to be on the show, and anytime, you know, two brothers can get together, you know, and share about our faith. I know Scripture says that we're two or more gathered in the name of Jesus, that His Spirit is there with us. So, you know, I'm pumped. Let's do this.
Okay. You know, I guess one of the things I'd like you just to respond to is, you know, it's a funny thing in today's world. We're kind of seeing that if you're kind of, quote, good, you know, if you're a good person, you're a good athlete, that you're somehow seen as maybe sort of being a little bit weak or something, you know. And then on the other hand, if you're kind of seen as this bad boy kind of, you know, image and so forth, you're somehow seen as like you're the kind of the better athlete or you're more competitive or something like that. You know, so, you know, what do you think of that whole idea and this idea that somehow you can't be a world-class athlete and still have virtue?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Dr. Bill. I know sometimes when you think of, like, oh, a major league ball player, you think of a guy that, you know, maybe has long hair, has big goatee, big muscles, tattoos all over his body, the kind that'll, when he gets out, flip over a Gatorade cooler and, you know, cussing and screaming and throwing bats. But I mean, for me, I'm so proud to be a Catholic man of God that when I'm on the baseball field, you know, a lot of people think that if you're a Christian that you should be soft and passive out there. But for me, it actually makes me play with a passion and a fire that I don't think I could play at that level without Christ. Because when I'm out there, I think my game is centered around one concept. I play for my audience of one. And when I'm on that field, you know, there are fans that are booing sometimes, but I envision Jesus Christ sitting in that front row right above my dugout, and I just envision him clapping and saying, "That's my boy. You know, you go out there and you play hard, and you represent me well with your attitude and the way you concentrate and the way you run those bases." And for me, I play that game so hard, not to please the fans, but I play it to please the Lord. And, you know, I think I don't need to have the long hair. I don't need to have the goatee or the tattoos or the steroids or, you know, to be that intense person, because I feel like as Christian men, we should be like William Wallace in Braveheart. We should be men of virtue. We should be men of faith that are passionate about things that are good. So
right.
I think if we truly embrace our faith the way God wanted us to, we would be amazing husbands. We would be amazing fathers. We'd go out and work hard to provide, and we would really be, you know, champions for the Lord, and playing for our audience of one is something that I've really adopted in my life.
Well, it's funny. I just give you something to maybe also think about, because what you just triggered there was something that's very close to me. Being at a Benedictine college, a Catholic Benedictine college, the Benedictines have a way of receiving guests, and it's called they welcome each guest in persona Christi, as Christ, meaning they literally, like I do too, I'm an oblate of that monastery, so is my wife, you know, we see Christ in every person, like really see Christ in every person.
Wow.
And so imagine the welcome you're supposed to give somebody if you actually see the second person of the Trinity, our God, in that person. That should be an awesome welcome. That goes way beyond hospitality.
Amen. And, I like that. And, you know, sometimes we get caught up in ourselves and think, oh, man, we need to, you know, you often hear it at church sometimes, man, you need to be a living example of a Christian, because you might be the only Jesus that someone sees. But I think, like you said, with the Benedictines, the better way to approach life is for us to see Jesus in every single person that we meet.
You are right. And the next time you see that stadium filled up, then you can see Jesus Christ in each one of those individuals there, you know? So I mean, it kind of multiplies it, you know?
Exactly. Amen. I'm right with you on that, Doc.
What's hot? Today I wanted to maybe talk a little bit about a relatively, I guess, old movie, an old book by Ernest Hemingway called Old Man and the Sea. It may be one that you've either had to read when you were in school, or maybe at least you've heard about it. Sometimes you may have heard people, you know, refer to somebody as the old man in the sea. But the story I found fascinating because it's really a study in character, and it's very personal and up close development of just really one particular person, even though there's a couple of other people in it. But it's this old man. He's a fisherman. He lives in Cuba, and it's a, you know, a time where, you know, the economy's not very good. But he's a simple fisherman, like most of the people of the island where he lived. And he's now pretty old. I don't know what I guess his age would be, but, you know, certainly it seemed like he was maybe in his, you know, late 60s or something like that. And the story really follows about this, you know, young boy who is sort of, you know, apprenticed to him in some way, and you know, sees him as a mentor and you know, loves him and supports him as best he can. But the old man has to go out by himself because he hasn't been very successful in terms of catching fish. And basically they go out looking for swordfish. And so he goes out in his boat alone, and he keeps coming back, and it's been now, you know, weeks and weeks since he's caught a fish. And, you know, other fishermen are catching fish, and the boy is in another boat now because his parents want him to be with, I guess, a successful fisherman, and felt like the old man was past his time. So finally the old man goes out on this one, you know, long, long trip, and I won't take you through the whole thing if you haven't heard the story, but they do such a great job, both Ernest Hemingway in terms of his description of the character in the book, and the book and the movie are different. I always find that when I read a book about a movie, the book is just so much more detailed, and your imagination is, you know, in some ways just so much more vivid. But it is a very good movie. Who is it? Tracy plays the old man in the sea in the movie, Spencer Tracy. And he just does such a good job of developing, you know, the difficulty. And he's sort of having a conversation in his mind that you get to hear as he's out there in the boat by himself. But he catches this great fish, which is like, you know, once-in-a-lifetime fish. And ultimately, nobody will have ever seen one, you know, like this. And I won't take you through the whole end because it doesn't end maybe the way you think it will. But it goes through his just, you know, physical, actual, almost torture, if you will, struggle, sacrifice, in order to land this fish, and his relationship and the way he thinks about this it just gives great insights about, you know, human being. It also, you know, makes me think a little bit. I'm at Belmont Abbey College, which is a Benedictine college, and we have a Benedictine monastery there, and the monks are there, and kind of seeing the life of the Benedictine monks. You know, it's this day in and day out life where it's not flashy. There's no great charismatic stuff, you know, going on. There's no rockets going off. It's the day in and day out life that they live that leads them to holiness. And I think it's also something for us as well, you know, to be led to this kind of idea of holiness in our lives. Because I know for all of us, we see every day, you know, many days seem mundane. We do the same thing day after day. We either go to school, go to work, go to practice, whatever it might be. And you know, after a while, you could say, is there any more exciting stuff? And I think that's why we run around so much trying to buy things and do things, because we're trying to fill ourselves up. But this old man in the sea kind of brings us back to see life in this kind of simple way, and to see the day in and day out of living of life that, in a sense, brings us through our own inadequacies and weaknesses to really a place where we become, in a sense, holier. We have more of a relationship with God through our weakness. We're brought closer to Him. And so I'd strongly recommend that you check out the book and the movie.
Praying Twice.
This is ICU from AMR and Robert Lee McClure.
dance, come and love me. Dance, dance, come my love. Dance, dance, come and love me. Dance. Dance, dance, come and love me. Dance, dance, come my love. Dance, dance, come and love me.
Singing I See You. You can check them out at garageband.com or just check out our show notes at reclaimthegame.com. It's your call. Today I received a question about nutrition. People are asking, you know, how do you eat right? And this idea of, you know, seeing the body, you know, as a temple. What should we be doing? How do we fuel this body that we have? And I would say that, you know, one, I do think that concept of the body as a temple is the right one, in that it's, we're fueling ourselves and we're focused on ourselves, not out of selfishness, but out of the desire to want to serve others. And so we need to be prudent and do what's appropriate to take care of our bodies in order to be able to do that well. The nutrition side, there's probably people laughing right now that know me, because I'm probably like the worst eater in the world. I'm like a picky eater, and I always have been. And I remember when I was in college, I used to maintain my weight. When I was jumping, I maybe weighed about 200 pounds, maybe 205 pounds. That's probably one of the heaviest high jumpers in the world. At a certain point, you might think being 6'8 is a good thing, but when you're 6'8, about 205, that's a lot to get over a bar. But anyway, to maintain my weight at the degree I was working, I had to eat almost 6,000 calories a day. Now, for a guy who's a picky eater and doesn't eat a lot, that is a job, because I used to go into the dining hall, and I mean, first of all, you don't learn, by the way, till you get out of school how much food costs. But, you know, thank God I didn't have to pay for every meal that I was eating in that dining hall. But I would go in there at dinner and I would eat like 3 plates of dinner. I'd have like 8 glasses of chocolate milk. I'd have ice cream. I'd have rolls. I'd have, oh my gosh. And, you know, I could barely move after I finished eating. And believe it or not, this only maintained my weight. So, you know, nutrition has been something that I've had to, at least when I was competing, I needed to focus on. I'd gone to a nutritionist and tried to get some assessment of what I needed to do. I tried to, you know, do some supplements. There's always questions about whether vitamins and so forth are very effective. But I think if you're not eating well, or you're not eating, in a sense, a rounded diet, then some supplementation can certainly be of benefit to you. I would say, though, that if you're a fortunate person that, you know, your taste buds aren't too sensitive and that you like most foods, there's ways for you to eat a very balanced diet. And maybe for most of you, the challenge is not so much not liking things as much as you like too many things. And so, you know, you eat too much food. Part of it is just trying to figure out, depending on what you're competing at, what are you trying to do and what are you trying to accomplish, and understanding how proteins, carbohydrates, fats, I mean, how do they all play into your diet and your level of performance? And it's a little bit long to go into it here, but I'll try to put up some things maybe on the show notes to talk about that, and I'll direct you there. Hope that answers your question. And in the future, if you know, give me some more of your comments, I'd appreciate it. Our listener line, which is 206-203-1301, or you can write me at feedback@reclaimthegame.com. Skills and drills. Today I want to talk about something that I know everybody is interested in, and that is speed. How do you develop it? And I thought I'd take out a few excerpts from a pretty good book. It's called Sports Training Principles by Frank W. Dick. And it's really good. A lot of his work that I think went into this book came from much of the East German research into sport training when there back was in East Germany. They were obviously very focused on the scientific advances of high-level athletic performance. And so I thought I'd just share with you some of these things that, I'll give you a couple of tips on how to actually, you know, what kind of drill can you do that would actually increase your speed. But I thought I'd just give you some insights about speed itself, just so that you really understand it. Because like anything, the more better you understand something, the more you can do with it in terms of your training and make sure that you're kind of covering all the bases, so to speak. Well, when he talks about speed development, he says, okay, speed and practice. And he's basically saying there's seven areas in sports performance where training will enhance speed. He says, first, there's the reaction to the signal. So, for example, if you're in swimming or track or something like that where there's actually a signal that begins, that's sort of your reaction time. The tennis player, it may be a reaction to a volley or to an actual serve coming at him or her. The second is a capacity to accelerate. So it's not just how fast are you once you're at, you know, kind of what would be considered top speed, but it's how do you go from that, you know, standing still moment all the way up to your top speed. And so it's, you know, really an important part of speed development. The third is capacity to rapidly adjust balance following execution of one technique in order to prepare to execute another. So, for example, if we talked about something like soccer, you're sprinting, you're trying to do it at high speed. At the same time, you need to adjust your balance and move your body in such a way that you can still strike a ball. The fourth area is achievement of maximum speed. I guess that is pretty obvious and goes without saying that basically what you're saying is that, I should say it this way. Often speed is mistakenly thought of as an entity by itself, and it's not. It's a sophistication of technique where all the demands of the technique are performed at the highest speed consistent with the general synchronized framework. It's a very fancy way of saying that there's a lot of coordination and timing of muscle stretching, contracting, specific timing of movements and so forth that really help you achieve what would be considered maximum speed. The fifth area is capacity to maintain maximum speed over over a period of time, once it's been reached. Former world record holder in the 100 meters was only able to maintain top speed for about 20 meters. Now, he was doing that. He was covering 12.05 meters per second. That's pretty incredible. But that's only for 20 meters. And so the question becomes, can you extend that? Or at least can I, right now, are you extending it that far when you're sprinting? The sixth level here is capacity to limit the effect of endurance factors on speed, which means as you hit this high level, what is the reason why you slow down and when does it start to happen? And the first thing that happens, believe it or not, is that your coordination, the quality of your movement, even though you don't feel suddenly, kind of out of control, but your coordination of movement actually begins to break down, and that's what begins to slow you down. And then seven, the capacity to choose correct action options. And that means not only is it about your running speed over the ground, but it's your mental speed. It's your ability to make decisions as you're moving. So as far as training for speed development, there's certain things that are going to help you to do that. Just as with strength training practices, an athlete, has to master certain kinds of technique. Without technique, you can't be fast. So the first thing is you got to develop a level of general conditioning, just in terms of your basic, wind, as they would say, your aerobic endurance, and your muscular strength in order to begin to learn what the basic technique is. And in this case, if we're talking about running or sprinting, how do you do that and how do you do it well? The second is, as you've learned the sound technique, continuing to master it. The third, I'd say, would be develop a level of specific conditioning which permits you to progress in sophistication of your technique. So in the beginning, although you'll have a certain basic conditioning, it requires, more specific types of strength and conditioning in order to have your technique kind of reach its optimal. And then the real key and what you're ultimately looking for is, can you keep this technique at speed? So ways to do this, and I'll just kind of throw out a couple of them that he mentions here in his book, are the technical components need to be learned and stabilized at slower speeds. And that makes sense. In the beginning, if you're going it all out, it's very difficult to have any kind of technique simply because the patterns haven't been laid down. So for example, one thing you might want to do practically speaking is if you want to work on your speed development would be, let's say you're going to run 75 yards or 75 meters. You would concentrate first maybe on the first 40 meters of really running with what is perfect technique. And I can't go into that right now, but there's ways to develop your running technique to be pretty precise in it. But then for those first 40 meters, you're just concentrating on technique. You're running well within yourself, maybe at 75% of your ability. And then the last 30 meters or 35 meters, you really try to raise the speed and accelerate holding the same type of technique and form. As an example, a tennis player may bring down the speed during a service in order to be able to place a ball accurately on the court, on the service court, and then to feel kind of the synchronization of how like all of these parts of his body or her body are moving. And then over time, what you'd want to try to do is gradually build up the speed with which you do that. That's kind of dealing with the intensity side of things. The extent is really looking at how do you load this kind of thing. So techniques can be repeated, you know, to some degree with high volume and high intensity, but they only can be done in small little units over small periods of time or short periods of time. And so it's important that in sprinting, the minimum distance to develop acceleration is that which allows the athlete to achieve near maximum speed. So for this, you know, in track and field, it's maybe 30 to 40 meters. But in soccer, let's say, for example, it might only be 5 or 10 meters that you need to, because that's the nature of the game. And so you need to be able to develop this acceleration component. And in sprinting, most athletes require 5 to 6 seconds to achieve their maximum speed. And so that suggests that a distance of 50 to 60 meters are required to develop kind of the linking of this initial acceleration and the pickup to maximum speed. So that gives you an idea of the range where, you know, you're working on maximum speed. And then as far as like numbers go, well, how much of these things do you do? The key thing when you're working on speed is that you need to have very short recovery time. So something like, you know, 4 to 6 minutes, when I say short recovery times, I'm saying short distances with longer recovery times, you know, maybe 4 to 6 minutes between each run in order for your body to, in a sense, recover as fully as it possibly can. And typically you're doing, you know, relatively small sets and repetitions within that. So you might be doing, you know, for example, a speed type workout might be 3 times 100 yards. You're taking, you know, doing them all out, but you're doing maybe a 4 to 6 minute recovery between each one. Maybe then take a fuller recovery. And then again, you might repeat maybe 3 more of those. And that might be your entire speed workout for the day. So it wouldn't be something that you leave feeling really, in a sense, exhausted like you typically do from doing a lot of work. You may be tired from the intensity that you put out, but it won't be the same kind of fatigue that you experienced. Now, I'll just leave you with this one last tip. The one thing that you can do in a constructive way to develop your speed is what's called overspeed. And you can do that in maybe 2 ways I'll give you. One would be if you could find a gradual, maybe a 40-meter downhill. It would have to be very gradual. Sometimes people think, I'm going to do downhill running. I need this big, like, ski slope. You'll kill yourself, and you'll have terrible technique. So you need something that's a very gradual downhill, like maybe only 6 degree kind of hill. That's about it, 6 to 10 degrees at most. You want to be able to maintain really perfect technique, and you allow the fact that you're running downhill to be the thing that helps you to move at a speed faster than you're really capable of. So in essence, it's how you can then run and experience running and your body moving at a speed greater than your normal 100%, and you're doing it hopefully with pretty decent technique. The other way you can do it is in today's world, we have all these great gadgets. You got Perform Better catalogs, all kinds of people out there selling all kinds of sports performance devices. They have different things like a pulley type device, or they have these like surgical tubing type bands that you can stretch out, which help you to accelerate and then to carry a speed greater than what you can. But again, it's not try to drag yourself as fast as you possibly can. After you get over maybe, you know, up to maybe, again, 5-10% above your maximum speed, you're going to begin to fall apart technically, and you start to lose the benefit of actually having done it. But to the degree you can do some overspeed training, that will certainly help your speed development.
Iron will.
Often we have emotions that come over us and we're not quite sure even why we have them. But I challenge you to think about this. These emotions that we have, or the feelings that we get, really come from what we believe. And I'm going to give you a little way of maybe understanding this by way of a story. I want you to imagine you and I are together and we need to work on a project. And we've been given some instructions on how to do this, and we're about to begin this project when another person walks in, and we've asked them then to come up and, okay, we're going to figure this out together. And you hand them the book and you say, okay, listen, you read out the instructions to us, and we'll make notes, and, you know, we'll begin to sort out and make an outline of what we have to do. But the person having just walked in says, well, okay, but what are we doing? And again, very, very politely, very kindly, you say, well, look, we'll sort it out. Let's just begin with the beginning and, you know, read this off. We'll take the notes and we'll go from there. And he says, well, I don't know if I want to do that. And, you know, soon an argument ensues, and this person gets really, you know, really angry, kind of almost out of your character. You're wondering what the heck's going on here. But he gets so mad, he starts yelling and screaming at you, and he throws the book at you. Well, what's your first thought about this person? Well, most people I've asked that question of will say, may not be the most Christian thing to say, but they'll say, well, he was a real jerk. And I can understand how maybe somebody could come to that conclusion. But what if I told you now that person can't read? Oh, I didn't know that. Now, what's interesting is how emotions do come and go. Sometimes you think, oh, I can't help it. I just feel this way. Well, what this is showing is that's not really true. Because what we just proved is that when you thought this person could read and they act in this inappropriate way, yelling and screaming and throwing the book, you get mad. You get ticked off at that. Now, 2 seconds later, not 2 years from now, not 2 months from now, 2 seconds later, I give you a new belief. And the new belief is he can't read. Well, it's like a switch gets flicked in your head. And suddenly you go, oh, I didn't know that. And now suddenly you have empathy. Now, wait a second. You just went from anger to empathy. Those are like opposite ends of the spectrum. And it didn't take you forever to get there. It happened almost automatically. So part of understanding how we work is also understanding how other people work. Now, you might say to me, well, okay, I get this idea. But let me tell you, it's going to hopefully give us some insight about how to deal with those people in our life that are difficult to handle. And those are the people that sometimes come off very obnoxious, kind of braggadocial in some way. They're people that kind of annoy us that we really don't want to be around. They're the kind of people that you try to get away from, to be honest with you. And you may think, well, they just like being that way. Well, wait a second. The most motivating thing to any human being is love. Somebody who is doing something that makes you want to push them away or get away from them means they're not getting what? They're not getting your love, which is what they want most of all. So it seems kind of crazy, doesn't it? The thing they want most, they're doing things that actually don't get it. They actually do things, in essence, that are opposite. They're actually pushing you away, which, by the way, is part of a downward spiral for them because they keep doing these things over and over then, which just make it that much worse. So now you might say to me, well, okay, what do you mean here with this reading example? Well, what I'd say to you is a reading skill is very much like other skills we have. Our ability to communicate is a skill. To some degree, the ability to love is a skill. And so we're going to encounter people that, in essence, if you can get this idea, don't read or they can't read. And instead of us assuming they can, which gets us angry, if we could recognize right from the start this person can't read, I would have greater empathy for them. So you might say to me, well, how do I know that if I'm in a situation, it's not me that can't read? And what I'd say to you is, well, you can take a little test. You can ask yourself, do you want to be in the other person's shoes? And if we're dealing with one of these kind of people I'm talking about, it doesn't take you more than a second to say no. You say, no, I don't want to be in their shoes. Well, why? Because I'd be miserable if I was in their shoes. And so I'd say to you, well, okay. Now you might say, well, but they seem to like it. They have an attitude. They don't seem like they're sorry or humble. I mean, they have a cocky attitude about the whole thing. And, I think they like being this way. Well, wait a second. What you're trying to tell me is that the person who really wants love, doing this thing that doesn't get it for him, is really liking this and enjoying it. The analogy I could give you is this. Let's say one night we went bowling. We're in the bowling alley. I look over at the next lane, and you see the guy there, and he picks up a ball. And he drops the ball on his foot. And then he picks up the ball and he drops it on his foot again. And then he picks up the ball and he drops it on his foot again. You are not going to turn to me and say, hey, the guy over there in lane two is having a great time. You are going to say, there is something wrong with the guy over in lane two. And by the way, it doesn't matter how he acts. It doesn't matter whether he smiles, he cries, he screams. You're going to say there is a problem. Because clearly this person is hurting themselves. And anybody that hurts themselves has a problem. So in essence, this person who has this attitude that you're feeling maybe likes being that way or doing that, they're hurting themselves. They're losing the thing they want most. And so if we can recognize that in people, it'll do two things. One is it'll help us to love that person more. It'll help us to be empathetic and to realize they got a problem. It's not my problem, but at least I can be empathetic to it. And number two, it then helps me not to get wrapped up and to have certain emotions that I don't really want to have that are going to hurt me, my life, and maybe my relationships. And so that's just some ideas that I'd like to share with you, and hopefully that'll be of help to you as you deal with some difficult people in your life.
Soul Food.
There's a great little book called Trustful Surrender to Divine Providence, The Secret to Peace and Happiness. It's by Father Jean Baptiste Saint-Jure, and there's also a section in there by, I think it's Blessed Claude Colombier. And it's a really nice little short book. It's very simple. It's very easy to read. And basically, the whole book is talking about that our ultimate you know, peace and happiness in this world is when we trust in God, we trust in His providence completely. And that's sometimes a very difficult thing for us to do. I mean, think how often we say, oh, what a dreadful day it is. It's so hot today. Or we'll say, oh, I can't believe this cold. It's so freezing. We're always complaining about the way things are. And basically, you know, we're left to a certain illogic there in our own minds if we're doing that. Because if we say we believe in God, then we don't believe in luck. We're not saying things just happen sort of randomly. We're saying things happen by design. And so, you know, as you may or may not know, not that I'm a great theologian by any means or philosopher, but my understanding is that, you know, God can directly will something or He can allow something to be. So the reason He allows us to do certain things that we may look at and say, well, why would God allow that to happen? Well, God allows us to do certain things because He's given us free will in order that we can love Him and choose Him. And so sometimes things do happen in the world that we say, well, why would God do that? And by the way, I find that very interesting that the bad things in life, we say, why did God let that happen? The good things that happen, we say, wow, wasn't I lucky? Or weren't you lucky that that happened? I don't know why we don't attribute the good things to God and maybe the bad things to bad luck, but we tend not to do that. And so this book is just a wonderful little reminder, and it's very simple, and when you read through it, I almost guarantee as you're reading it, and by the way, you can go almost anywhere in the book. You don't have to start at the front. You can almost open up to any page as you read it. You'll go, oh yeah, yep, that's true. And basically what he's saying is be thankful in all things. You know, accept all things. Doesn't mean that you don't try to make life better or do everything that you can do with your skills, talents, and abilities, but he is saying accept providence in your life, because that is the true secret to peace and happiness. And through that, it is a way that we can accept the tragedies and the difficulties that do come up in life, whether it be for others or for ourselves. Well, I enjoyed our time together today, and I hope that we'll have many more. You can leave me your comments at 206-203-1301 or write to me. Send me your feedback at reclaimthegame.com. And also, I have a blog going right now, so I'd like you to check that out as well and give me your thoughts and comments on that too. So take care, God bless, and I'll see you soon.